Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Boundary Training in Schools conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance, please press star, then zero. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Karen Ann Brough. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Again, I'm Karen Ann Brough, a senior risk analyst at United Educators. In today's roundtable, we are going to discuss boundary training, which is designed to promote healthy relationships involving adult school employees, volunteers, and students. Let me start by introducing our two speakers, whose biographies are included in the roundtable reference materials that were sent to our listeners. David Wolowitz is a partner in the New Hampshire law firm of McLean, Groff, Rollerson, and Middleton. He specializes in representing independent schools and often conducts trainings for educators and students. Welcome to our roundtable, David.
Hello, Karen Ann.
Okay, we're delighted to have you.
Thank you.
Jane Bluestein has authored several books and also trains on topics related to relationship building in schools as well as effective instruction and guidance. Early in her career, she worked as a classroom teacher, a crisis intervention counselor, and also held other positions in schools. Thanks for joining us, Jane.
Thanks for having me.
And it's great to have you. Listening in today, we have approximately 230 people from 125 schools, universities, and brokerage firms. Before we get started, here are a few preliminaries. First, I hope everyone received the roundtable reference materials and evaluation form. Those were sent out by email last week. If you did not get those items, please contact us at risk@ue.org, and we'll send them to you after the roundtable. And please take a moment to fill out the evaluation form at the end of the program and fax or email it back to us. We are taping today's roundtable as we do all of our programs. An audio MP3 file will be available on the UE website at www.ue.org about a week from now. Our next roundtable will be in March of next year on the subject of fire safety. Finally, I want to remind everyone that our roundtables are not designed to provide legal advice. Our roundtable today will feature 40 minutes of dialogue with our speakers and about 20 minutes to take questions from our listening audience. At any time during the roundtable, you may send us your questions by email at risk@ue.org. Later in our program, we will also give instructions on how to call in your questions. Now let's get started. If you wish to follow a written agenda, please see page 4 of the roundtable materials. First, we'll discuss the general concepts of boundaries, and second, what constitutes healthy boundaries in relationships. Our third and fourth topics address how boundary training is conducted for adult school staff and students, respectively. And finally, our speakers will respond to some case studies before taking questions from our audience. Jane, let's start with you. What are boundaries?
Well, boundaries, most of us think of boundaries as limits or where we start and where other people begin. My focus in the work that I do uses boundary setting as a way for adults to give information, well, people in general of all ages, to give people the information they need to help them to connect with us, to let them know what their options are and how to be successful in the relationships with us. We bring boundaries in from the field of psychology. They're also used in business fields, and it really helps us decide who we are, what our tolerances are, what our preferences are, and it allows us to communicate these with others.
All right. Let's get a little more specific. David and Jane, can you give us examples of boundary issues that arise for both adult employees, volunteers, and students at school?
Sure. This is David. Let me make it clear that boundaries are not just physical boundaries. They could be language boundaries, clothing boundaries, time boundaries, place boundaries. So let me give you a quick couple of examples. A physical boundary would be touch, such as a hug. A hug might be appropriate in some circumstances in a school with younger elementary students and not maybe with older. It could be a dress boundary, something that you'd wear on a date. You probably would not wear on some dates. You might not wear in school. And language boundary is another one. Familiar language, such as nicknames, and familiar language that you might use with your friends or colleagues, you might not want to use with students.
You know, when I was teaching, so many boundary potential boundary violations or crossings can come out of such innocent situations or seemingly innocent situations. I know when I was working with kids, little kids or older kids, I know that sometimes just the touch, you know, just like even putting a hand on a shoulder, those kind of things. Some of these kids, that was really the only positive touch they got. You have to really watch, though. You know, even things like teachers who have websites where they would post assignments or information for students, if they put family photos on there, you know, we really are held to a different set of standards. If I run into one of my kids at a rock concert, for example, I have to be clean and sober and dressed like an adult because that's how they know me. And to see me out on the street, you know, it's, you know, you get into some fuzzy areas there.
All right. Well, thank you for those examples. You've both indicated that some boundary crossings are not harmful, whereas some may have some negative consequences. David, can you explain this distinction?
Yes. I encourage people when talking about this topic to make a distinction between boundary crossings and boundary violations. Boundary crossings are common, inevitable. They occur in everything we do every day in all of our relationships, and they're benign, neutral occurrences, such as shaking hands when greeting a new acquaintance, hugging when greeting a friend, kissing when greeting a loved one. Whereas boundary violations are harmful or potentially harmful, and they often involve exploitation or misuse of the relationship. But there's degrees of boundary violations. Some are relatively minor and remediable if quickly addressed. Others are extreme and harmful. Let me give you a quick example of a relatively minor violation that's remediable. For example, a teacher dealing with a student gossips about another teacher and regrets it immediately and wishes he or she didn't do it. If the teacher immediately corrects that mistake and says, you know, I shouldn't have done that, and uses it as a teaching moment, then the violation has been remedied.
You know, I think there's something kind of intuitive in addition to that. You know, we all know when something feels okay and when it doesn't. And we teach little kids, even preschool kids, about, you know, good touch, bad touch, and tell them to trust their gut and how things feel. Bottom line, I think if it feels creepy, it probably is. If you've got a kid who's a little too close to you, or, you know, you're feeling like, boy, I really could use another adult in the room right now, I would really encourage people to act on that and trust that intuition, because it's probably true.
All right. Well, thank you for those tips and rules of thumb. Let's shift our focus now to how boundary training helps promote healthy relationships in schools. At the outset, I'd like to point out that our speakers have somewhat different approaches in their training programs. David, let's start with you. Why do you feel that boundary training is necessary, and what is your approach?
Well, first of all, I think it's necessary because a single high-profile incident can have a devastating impact on a school's reputation, and it can even harm or ruin a school financially. A school's reputation for safety nowadays is as important to parents as its academic reputation. Another reason I think it's necessary is because I've learned as a lawyer that typical legal risk management advice is insufficient. Telling schools to rely on background checks and have good policies and have training on laws such as bullying, hazing, and harassment, while they're all very important to do, I find that they're inadequate because a lot of sexual and even other extreme misconduct directed at students is committed by persons who have no history of past misconduct and are often involved in behaviors that you'd want to catch long before they reach the level of a legal violation. Basically, good people often go astray. So I encourage, through this kind of training, schools to focus on the causes of improper conduct and not just on the legal and extreme symptoms. transgressions often start with good intentions, and then through a series of small steps, they get worse over time and go down what we call the often called the slippery slope, and where the person who's engaged in the poor behavior is no longer able to exercise self-restraint or good judgment. So the goal is to address these behaviors that are not extreme early, before they violate rules, violate laws. And by doing boundary training, we are helping people develop a healthy self-awareness, hopefully in people who might otherwise not have it. And in the event that there are people who don't develop that healthy self-awareness and healthy boundaries, we're hoping that this enables their colleagues who observe the behavior to consult with them and deal with it at an early basis.
All right. Well, thank you. Jane, how do you approach boundary training?
Well, I use it to, you know, I work with boundaries to help schools build a safe emotional environment and healthy, positive school cultures. I came to using boundaries as a discipline approach because, just like what David was saying about, you know, not focusing so much on the legal aspects, just because we have a list of rules and laws doesn't make people behave. I've never seen a kid just about to misbehave and go, oh, darn, there's a rule. You know, so we're looking at how do we create an environment where we use boundaries to help motivate and reinforce kids and to build responsibility and accountability without using threats or punishments and here's the rule, here's the punishment, here's what we do the fourth time you're caught, you know, is so that the kids know ahead of time what they need to do to be successful. Here's how you get to use this equipment. Here's how you get to work in this group. Here's how you get to move on to the next book. The other thing that I love about using this, you know, boundaries in a discipline context as a way to motivate, it also is a great way to accommodate kids' needs for power and to help them learn what their limits are and how to take care of themselves and stick up for themselves. It's a huge component of self-esteem, and it's a huge component of positive behavior. When kids have their power needs met in positive ways, we typically see a reduction in kids acting out to get power and attention in negative ways.
All right. Well, we can see that boundary training encompasses many different aspects. And while you both have different approaches, I know that you both provide some training on what we call the so-called risk factors for unhealthy relationships. David, let's start with you. I know that you've identified four such risk factors. Would you describe them for us?
I will. And let me first say that the reason I think the risk factors are important is if you're aware of them, then it makes it much easier to avoid risky situations and to identify them. The first risk factor is the imbalance of power that exists in almost every situation, but usually in an educational setting, it's magnified. The teacher is in a position of authority over the student. It's always the responsibility of the person with the greater authority or power to set appropriate behavioral limits with the person in the subordinate position. The second risk factor has to do with role confusion. And one of the things we do is teach the vocabulary of boundaries and risk management in this kind of training, and roles is one of them. Most educators and staff members in a school situation engage with students in various roles. A teacher is almost always more than a teacher. A teacher can be an advisor, also a coach, sometimes also an administrator, a tutor, many things. And the roles change from situation to situation and over time. And the behavioral expectations change for each situation. Failure to keep those roles clear can lead to problems. So, for example, we know that a coach acts like a coach on the field. Usually they're dressed like a coach. Then the coach comes back to the classroom and is dressed like a teacher and is in a classroom and acts like a teacher. But what happens if the same person, who's both a coach and a teacher, is not in the classroom, not on the field, and interacting with the student, and the student's confused about the role? That can lead to problems. Another risk factor is acting in isolation. Private interactions are really a high risk. They can occur anywhere, classrooms, automobiles, homes, etc. When an adult and student go outside their normal established routines and roles, such as special hours, special arrangements, and things that are not reviewed and happen in isolation, that's high risk. And then finally, as we've already mentioned, adults who have poor skills in recognizing and setting boundaries are at high risk for misconduct. Let me just give you one simple and obvious example about of someone who is either oblivious to or ignoring boundaries, appropriate boundaries. Just think of a social situation or a work situation where someone comes up to you and is carrying on what should be a normal conversation, but instead they progressively close the distance between them and you until they're talking right into your face. That person is violating your boundaries, even if they're not aware of it and even if they're not touching you.
All right. Well, that's a pretty comprehensive list of risk factors. Jane, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I want to add something that, you know, one of the red flags that comes up for me is the tendency that we have as adults working with kids. We tend to reinforce a lot of people-pleasing behavior and use a lot of conditional approval to include and encourage, or to encourage this people-pleasing behavior. When you've got kids who are really conditioned and sort of geared towards, oh, I don't want to make this adult mad at me, or, oh, I want to make him happy. If you've got an adult who has crossed the line or is really suggesting something inappropriate, it's really hard for kids who have been told that they're safe and valuable when they're doing what other people want to learn how to say no and to stick up for themselves or to say, wow, this feels kind of weird to me. Even in resisting not just advances or inappropriate suggestions from adults, but also from peers. Peer pressure, too, we're very vulnerable if our need to please is greater than our need to take care of ourselves. We also have some cultural differences. I grew up in a community where there was a lot of, close talking, as David mentioned, you know, where people would be sort of closer to you than might be appropriate in other situations. There was a lot of touching. There was a lot of, emotion. We looked at one another in the face, and you know, you go to a different community or a different, you're dealing with kids with a different cultural or family background, and they may not be quite as comfortable with that kind of space or even direct eye contact. And I've seen kids who have been raised to not look at an adult in the face out of respect, and then you have the adults saying, look at me when I'm talking to you. So you've got these differences in culture. So these are all issues that I think can contribute to what ends up being that, you know, that creepy factor, the situation that is inappropriate.
Well, thanks to you both. Those are an excellent list of risky behaviors and situations that our schools can look out for. Let's move now to the third topic on our agenda, and that is how boundary training is conducted for adult employees and volunteers at schools. And let me point out that our presenters have shared some of their training outlines and materials. See our roundtable materials beginning at pages 16 and 19. Jane, let's start with you. How do you introduce the concept of boundaries in your training sessions?
Well, I look at them as an alternative to the rules and punishments that we use. So instead of saying to a group of kids, you know, if your homework isn't done, you are not going on this field trip, or if you're not going onto this next book, or if you don't put your materials away, you're not going out for recess. To focus instead on the positive consequences of the kids doing what you're asking, so that this gives kids a little bit more of an incentive. Because we're saying the same thing, telling a child, if you don't return that library book, you can't take another one home. You know, energetically is different, but, you know, in terms of logistics, you're saying the exact same thing when you focus on the positive. And you say, of course you can have another book as soon as you take the other one out. Then you're not doing it to, oh, I'm so happy when you bring your library book back, you know, or I'm really angry when you forget your book. Because then we've got that people-pleasing component in there. So I'm looking at it as a way to build cooperation in relationships, to let people know how they can get what they want and how to respect what you want. It's also a great way for us to learn how to communicate our needs, which is something that culturally very few people are really encouraged to do. We do a lot of passive-aggressive kind of things. this makes me responsible and accountable for letting people know what my needs and limits are. And it also helps us deal with kids' feelings and problems in a supportive way to help the kids seek solutions without enabling, fixing, or dismissing, or making judgments, or even telling them, here's what you should do about this. And it's great guidelines for even reinforcing positive behavior, so that when the kid brings the library book in, instead of saying, oh, I'm so proud of you, which, again, there's that people-pleasing, it's like, hey, fantastic, you brought your book back, now you can take another one out. So we've got boundaries as a way to use like guidelines or intervention strategies for handling different situations, because we use different adult behaviors to reinforce behavior than we do to motivate behavior, which is different than we use to intervene or deal with negative behavior.
All right. Well, thank you. David, how do you use boundaries in your training sessions with adult staff?
Well, I start out creating a common, neutral vocabulary so that when we're talking, we're all using the same language and preferably without a whole lot of baggage. So we define what roles are, what the power imbalance is, and we talk about boundary crossings and violations as we've been doing in this roundtable. Then I go through an exercise with the teachers and administrators, and I have them identify what their various roles are. It's pretty rare to meet a teacher that isn't in multiple roles. Then I focus on helping them understand the risks that we've talked about, and then we focus on how to avoid risky behavior. But one thing we talk about that's particularly important, because unfortunately not everybody avoids risky behavior. I think Jane said earlier, rules are not enough for students. Well, rules tend not to be enough for some adults as well. And avoiding risky behavior is hard for some adults, apparently. So what we want is, if this training isn't helpful for some people, that it should be, you would hope it would be helpful for, we want to empower that person's colleagues to have a way to productively identify the behavior and raise it and discuss it with them and educate them and hopefully change their behavior or otherwise deal with it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. You know, I just got a call from somebody recently, somebody I know and trust implicitly, somebody I actually go to for advice when I need advice or when I need research, you know, and for my writing or examples for my presentation. And this is somebody who came to teaching late in life because he really wanted to make a difference and cares about kids, and was in a situation where, you know, most of us go to teaching because we do care. And when we see somebody in distress or we see somebody who's upset, our first instinct is to want to support and comfort them, usually. And here's somebody who ended up being in a situation where physically was not close at all, but was talking to this person, and eventually, you know, got in a situation where he just put his hand on the child's shoulder, and now there's some question about the behavior coming up, because I think the parents are seeing the school as a deep pocket for, you know, and are filing charges now. You know, it's sad about how cautious we've all had to become. I mentioned that sometimes the affection and the contact we had with the kids that we worked with, whether at the elementary or even when I was working in day treatment with teens, that was the only positive physical contact they had. Bottom line, good teaching is about relationships, and I think everything kids learn, positive or negative, happens in the context of the relationships they have with the adults in their lives. We need to get that right. And good teaching means that teachers and students will connect emotionally and intellectually. And if all we're worried about is how to avoid risk, we're not going to really cut it as an educator.
Well, thanks for those comments. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about throughout is, what is the relationship between boundary training and school rules and sometimes laws that apply to behavior? David, how would you respond to questions like that?
Well, I want to respond to it, and I'm going to answer your question directly in 1 second. But I really want to address what Jane just said, and it is apropos to this topic. I feel strongly that good teaching is about making connections, and you can't be aloof or distant or risk-averse and be a good teacher. So boundary training should help and not hurt. It's not about you. If you have to worry about hard and fast rules and laws when you teach, you're not going to be an effective teacher.
Right.
That's one reason I've become a trainer, and one reason I've used this approach. Let me give you an example to answer your question, Karen Ann. There is a relationship between the laws and the rules and the boundaries. Let's use one specific example: hazing. If you've every one of your audience is in one state or another, and each state has a different hazing law, and if you ever look up those laws, you'll see that they're usually very complicated. There's a lot of elements or requirements to prove the criminal act of hazing. In fact, they tend to be so complicated that many schools have hazing rules that simplify the law. But they, nonetheless, they still say you can't do this or can't do that, and they describe, you know, hard and fast rules. Boundaries, on the other hand, as we've discussed, are have to do with behavioral limits between individuals. So, and it would be very unusual for students who engaged in hazing not to have taken steps leading up to it that violated boundaries, such as secret meetings, after-hour behavior, unreviewed behavior, et cetera. And that's why I feel that focusing on the boundaries can avoid the breaking of the rules and the breaking of the laws and catch it and manage behavioral risks earlier. And moreover, really, when you think about it, boundary training is really a teaching opportunity. And given that it's impossible to establish a rule for every situation and that students of different maturity and background are going to have different boundaries, and what's appropriate in one situation with a particular student may be inappropriate in another, and what's different in one grade, what's okay in one grade may be inappropriate in another, and even may vary from school to school, such as a religious school versus a public school, it's really impossible to have rules for every situation.
All right. Well, thank you to you both. Another question that we often get, it sort of arises from the example that Jane raised earlier about the teacher who was accused of improper conduct and putting his or her hand on the child's shoulder, is how does an employee, a volunteer, or a colleague of a teacher respond when they personally encounter or witness a boundary violation? Jane, let's start with you, and then David, what should a teacher or staff member do in terms of responding?
As far as the other people's behavior, I guess the main question for me is I want to look at the element of openness. Is this something that you would feel comfortable doing if the child's parent were in the room or if another colleague were in the room? And if it is something that is inappropriate, you know, that and you're not aware of it, if I see a teacher doing something, you know, it's really hard to approach somebody, because a lot of times it's just a difference in value systems. And I think you need a lot of trust and a very healthy school culture to be able to approach somebody and say, hey, are you aware of how close you were standing to that kid? Or are you aware how loud you were or how critical you were in talking to that child or whatever, without putting the other person on the defensive? And I know, David, a lot of the work that you do in terms of getting that vocabulary down, that, you know, you have ways of avoiding this. So I'd really like for you to speak to this. But my main issue is about openness. Is this something that you would feel comfortable doing in front of colleagues or in front of the child's parents? And a lot of times, if it is something that it's that creepiness factor again, if it feels weird, it probably is.
Well, I agree. But also another strategy, Jane, is to look at sometimes the teacher feels comfortable with it and assumes that other people would be comfortable with it, and they're just, for whatever the reason, not aware of how someone is reacting to it or might react to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, a situation where a teacher is praising a student on their appearance, you know, good grooming, good attire,
right,
would seem benign. But maybe another observer, another colleague, realizes that particular student is blushing and developing a crush, and the teacher is oblivious to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's nothing wrong with that. It's normal for these things to happen. the question, but obviously it's not something you want to continue. So how do you deal with it? One thing you don't want to do is say to the teacher, oh my God, you get the teacher to say, oh my goodness, and withdraw from all personal interaction with the student. That's going to, you know, make the student feel rejected and lose interest in the teacher and maybe in the class. So one thing you can do is talk about how, you know, it's just maybe there's a way to give the feedback to the student in a different way for good effort rather than good appearance, and also to spread the attention around and explain that the crushes are common.
Yeah, I think we also have to watch the type of feedback we give to different kids, because we do tend to focus on things with certain kids. I love the idea of making sure that every kid gets some kind of feedback, positive, on something beyond appearance, effort, work, improvement, any of those things.
Okay, well, thanks to you both. Let's shift now to the fourth topic, and that is boundary training for students. And David, let's start with you. Do you think it's important to train students as well on these issues? And if so, what are the goals for training students?
Yes, I do think it's important. I think it's a great teaching opportunity. And I also think it's an extraordinary help for teachers, because so many, when I do this training, I often get asked by teachers, they say, I try to set limits early and often, as you recommend with students, but I can't get them to set limits.
Right.
And one of the reasons is that the ones who don't get it are students who at home haven't learned boundaries or setting limits, and many of them are hungry for it. And even if they're not hungry for it, it's a skill they have to learn in life. So I encourage the teachers to use the same vocabulary or some version of it that they're using. That also reinforces it as part of the school's culture. And then it helps the teachers get a comfort level and the students get a comfort level in setting, identifying, and maintaining healthy boundaries early and often in relationships. And one way to do it is to talk, you know, to the students about practical strategies. And if you talk to students about practical strategies about setting boundaries and limits, you won't have any problem coming up with examples. They'll flood you with examples, talking about, you know, peer pressure and all of that, and privacy expectations, everything that adolescents or even younger students are concerned about.
Jane, do you have anything to add on training students?
Yeah, you know, I the main thing, I guess, is that we're not always going to be there to protect kids or to help when kids are being teased or hurt by other kids. I want kids to be able to learn how to stick up for themselves, and that really does require some boundary setting. I'm also concerned about some of the language and the techniques that we've given kids that actually can make the problem even worse and compound the problem. So, for example, if somebody's calling a child names, rather than telling the child, well, tell them how that makes you feel. If you've got a kid who says, well, when you call me names, it makes me feel bad, well, what if the kid's intent is to make the kid feel bad? I would much rather see the child learn how to set a boundary that would say, I don't hang with people who call me names. Do you see the difference in the shift in the energy there? There's a lot of assertiveness, and I'm much more likely to respect somebody who says, I don't do this. If you want to hang out with me, here's how you have to behave, than somebody who talks about all the issues that something's bringing up for them. That's their own personal thing. I think this is critical that we teach kids the way we role model, how we treat one another, is also real important. And I want to teach kids to respect themselves, and part of that is going to come from the language and the behavior I use as an adult in my relationship with them.
Okay. I'm going to jump ahead to the final part of our agenda before we take audience questions. And as time permits, I would like for our speakers to respond to these case studies that involve both adult-to-student and student-to-student relationships. I'll note for our audience that these case studies are intended to be somewhat open-ended to allow for a discussion of various facts that might come into play in these situations. Our first case study, which is listed at page 5 in the roundtable materials, refers to a computer science teacher that assigns her 10th grade class the task of setting up their personal MySpace accounts. The students are invited to link to the teacher's personal MySpace account. An email exchange develops between the teacher and one of her students, and the student asks the teacher's advice on things such as being shut out by the popular girls at school. Let's start with you, David, followed by any comments that Jane has. Have the teachers or students' boundaries been crossed or violated in this case study? And
sure,
how should the teacher respond?
Sure, I'll respond, and I'll do it quickly so that we can have our audience participate. A very short answer is that lots of boundaries have been crossed. The students are now interacting with the teacher on the web. That's a technological boundary, outside of school, physical boundary, location boundary, and on a personal level. The teacher is also self-disclosing personal information, and I'm assuming, without more facts, that the teacher means well and is acting in good faith, but a lot of warning signs are up here. She could be starting down a slippery slope of increasingly self-disclosing or creating student dependency or creating an unhealthy familiarity, and all of this is happening in isolation, in other words, not reviewed by the school.
Yeah, when you get into cyberspace and technology, it brings up a whole other set of problems. Even just asking kids to set up a MySpace account, you know, and a page, develop a page, could be a very legitimate opportunity for a learning activity. But let's make sure we really limit the amount of information we're encouraging kids to put out there, and to help them learn how to use the filters so that, you know, only the people they want to get on. I mean, there's a lot of problems that can come up with that. So I think you're walking some pretty risky territory there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Now, as I said, we're approaching the part of our program where our speakers will take questions from the audience. There are two ways to ask a question. The first way is to call in by telephone. To do this, please press the number 1 on your touchtone phone, and you'll be put into the queue to ask a question. And while you are waiting, if you decide for any reason that you don't want to ask your question, just press the pound key, and that will take you out of the queue. And the second way to ask a question at any time is to send in an email to risk@ue.org. That's risk@ue.org. While we're waiting for our audience questions, let me turn to the second case study. And here's a situation where a former semi-professional soccer player volunteers his time several afternoons a week in coaching 9th and 10th grade boys with their soccer skills. And this happens at school. At the request of the students' parents, the volunteer coach begins giving private soccer lessons to some of the boys on weekends. In addition to being paid for private lessons, the volunteer coach begins selling soccer gear to the families. It turns out he works part-time in an athletic supply company, and he's able to get the families 10% discounts on their merchandise. Jane, let's start with you on this one, followed by David. Have any boundaries been violated? And if so, how should the school respond to the activities of the volunteer coach?
Well, from the standpoint of boundaries, you know, I'm not an expert in law, and every school has its own policies for this. I'm a big fan of two things, documentation and communication. And so talk to the school. Find out ahead of time, is there going to be a problem with this? Let people know. It's that openness that we talked about earlier. If it's something that everybody knows about up front, then it doesn't become a real issue. Just the whole disclosure piece for me is the most important. And I think we can avoid a lot of these problems by just clearing it with the central office or with the school staff ahead of time.
David, do you have anything to add?
I do. I think Jane's points are excellent, but let's assume that it's all cleared, all communicated, and all allowed and appropriate. We're still in a situation where there's a potential for role confusion because
yeah.
There are so many roles.
Mm-hmm.
He's a volunteer coach at school, and now outside of school, he's a private tutor for pay, and in addition to that, he's a salesman of merchandise. He needs to make it clear that what the different roles are, and also be aware of the potential of how they could impact him from one role to the other. For example, does he only give the discount if you're his? Do you only get the discount if you use him as a tutor? If that's true, then he's using the power imbalance for his own personal advantage, and that wouldn't be a good idea, and it wouldn't go over well with some people. And that's one reason why you have to pay attention to those risk factors.
Yeah, looks like a conflict of interest from a lot of different angles.
Okay, well, thanks to you both. Let me remind our listeners that they can ask a question by pressing the number 1 on their touch-tone phone. And since we haven't gotten any emails in at risk@ue.org, let me ask that our listeners send their emails to bwickstrom@ue.org. That's bwickstrom@ue.org. Okay. While we're waiting for our audience questions, let's go ahead to the third case study, which is listed in the roundtable materials. And this one involves a student-to-student situation involving several female students. A head cheerleader gets an extra ticket to the big football game. The tickets are in very high demand. She tells three of her girlfriends that she hasn't yet made up her mind which special friend to give it to, but she will by a certain date. Each girl then proceeds to shower the cheerleader with attention. The one with a car offers her rides anywhere, anytime. The one with a rich family gives her expensive makeup, and the smart friend offers her free tutoring. No rules are violated, and a teacher finds out from a student who is offended by this whole situation. David, what should the teacher do?
This is a great teaching opportunity to educate this particular student, actually all of the students, but just the one with the cheerleader in particular, on boundaries, focusing on her. She's using the football game ticket and her status, popularity, as a bargaining chip, apparently to get attention or other things. And she really needs to be talked to and explained to her that her position comes with responsibility, not just with the power, which she's misusing. As someone who is in a position of leadership, it's a good opportunity to teach her what leadership is about, that it's not about selfishness. It's not about using your authority to benefit yourself. It's about putting others first and being fair. And then working with her to develop a strategy for handling this differently in a way that doesn't have this kind of an outcome.
You know, earlier I mentioned the whole thing about power needs, which, you know, developmentally normal kids will start to exhibit at about age 2. When kids learn how to get their needs for power and attention met in very positive ways, they don't have to resort to this kind of manipulation and power play kind of behaviors that we see in this example. You know, if I were the teacher, I would be very concerned about the other students, the ones who are doing favors for the head cheerleader. I want to know why they're selling themselves out just to get a ticket for a football game, and why is going to this game or just the status of having a ticket so important that they would be willing to, you know, cater to somebody else's whims to try to get her approval. Do you see how this keeps bringing up that people-pleasing issue, and that, if you know, you're safe and worthwhile and you'll get what you want as long as you're keeping other people happy? That can become extremely self-destructive very, very quickly. I want to teach kids how to stand up for themselves and how to make this not so important. It's like, yeah, I'd love to go with you. If you choose me, give me a call, rather than, oh, my God, what can I do to make you pick me? That's that kind of self-sacrificing behavior that is so dangerous in any kind of relationship, even adult relationships. I'd like to see us now focus our energies on helping kids who, you know, who have these kind of tendencies to learn some better self-managing and self-caring choices.
Well, thanks to you both for those excellent points. I'd like to remind our listeners that they can ask a question by pressing the number 1 on their touch-tone phone, or they can send an email to bwickstrom@ue.org. That's B-W-I-C-K-S-T-R-O-M at ue.org. While we're waiting for questions, I would like to go back to some material that was in our roundtable packet that was sent to our listeners, specifically at page 48, an article that Jane wrote called Finding a Safe Adult. And when we talk about training of students, this is something that could be useful. Jane, what advice do you give students on finding a safe adult to relate to?
Well, first of all, let me give credit to my co-author, Eric Katz, on this. He and I both came up with this in a book that we did called High School's Not Forever. We, throughout this book, continually advise kids who are having a hard time to find a safe adult, and we were amazed at the number of kids. We heard from over 2,000 children, you know, students, high school students and survivors, who felt that they didn't have anybody to talk to. So we're encouraging people that if you do need to talk, because it's really critical for every kid to have at least one adult who supports them unconditionally and who is safe for them, sometimes at home, sometimes at school. And we want to find adults who lead balanced lives, somebody who's consistent, who doesn't, you know, an adult who isn't going to make you feel uncomfortable. And these are not necessarily people who are trying to look cool. They're not going to badmouth others. They're not going to gossip. They're going to have very good boundaries themselves. And they're going to be able to set boundaries with kids. Kids know who to trust. I can walk into a school anywhere in this country, and within 5 minutes, I can tell you who the five adults in that school are who really like kids and who the kids trust. It doesn't take long, and kids are very open about talking about that.
Okay, thank you very much. Operator, I understand we have a caller on the line.
Yes, our first question comes from Deborah Martin from Phillips Academy. Your line is open.
Thanks for joining us today. What's your question?
Hi, you can hear me okay?
Yes.
Good. My name is Carlos. I don't expect a necessarily clear-cut answer to this, but one of the things I'm curious to hear your thoughts on is what is our level of responsibility regarding vigilance and supervision around boundaries in this electronic networking age? For example, you know, if it comes to our attention that a student has visited YouTube or, well, let's stay with YouTube, and seen a clip of a tape that features some of our students doing something that does cross a boundary, whether it's roughhousing or drinking or something of that sort, what's your advice about how we should be comporting ourselves in that sphere?
Okay, is everybody aware of what YouTube is? Do one of our speakers want to describe this for our audience in case anybody doesn't know?
I wish I had stock in it before Google bought it.
Gosh, no kidding.
YouTube is a place on the internet where people put clips of video taken by various means, usually in a flash drive format, but I guess the format's really irrelevant. Just they put moving pictures and sound often of people doing hopefully humorous things and not harmful or bad things. But what's happened is, and I see this all the time in my practice, a number of schools have discovered teams engaged in hazing activities or other students engaged in bad activities that violate school rules or simply show bad judgment or violate boundaries. And one answer to the questioner's inquiry is that in an independent school setting, it's certainly possible for an independent school to set to say that behavioral expectations for students apply outside of school as well, and that includes on the internet and anywhere that they are. In public school situations, it can be more difficult to address those things. Nonetheless, if something like that comes to a school's attention, obviously the school shouldn't ignore it, and at a minimum they should talk to the parents about it and educate the students on the risks or inappropriateness of what they're doing.
You know, once something's online, it's online, and it's available to anyone pretty much who can get online. So, you know, you've got that issue. You also have the issue here about kids disclosing if there's something that is going on in school. What kind of an environment do we have for reporting this kind of stuff? Is this a place where if a child comes and says, you know, to report that there is this incident or this, you know, this video online that is embarrassing or, you know, hurtful to another kid? This is a form of bullying. It's a form of hazing. And all the research that I've seen as far as reporting kids, bringing this to the attention of the adults, which I think is an aspect of this maybe slightly different from what the caller was asking about, not just about how schools handle this, but how schools find out about this. Do we have an environment where it's safe for a kid to come and say, hey, you may want to check this out? And, you know, but once it's online, boy, it's kind of hard. It's, you know, how do you unring that bell?
Well, actually, there's a website out there that's very well known, and newspapers go to it all the time because it collects clips from YouTube and all over the internet where school athletes behave poorly. And it's dedicated to just that. And a lot of schools that have had their reputations harmed because of the behaviors shown on that website.
I don't think kids realize how vulnerable they are when this information gets out there. And I certainly don't think that schools or educators are aware of how vulnerable we all can be under these circumstances.
All right. Well, thank you. Let me remind our listeners that they can ask a question by pressing 1 on the touch-tone phone or send an email to bwickstrom@ue.org. I do have a couple of email questions that have come in. The first one is from the Tuxedo Park School. And it says, all of your case studies that our speakers have discussed and most of the discussion has focused on high school. The example of the library book was an example of how dangers of teaching younger children can be if they are people-pleasing. Can you give more examples of boundary crossing in the elementary and early middle school years? Jane and David?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's really any difference in the dynamics of how this works. If you're talking to a child about, you guys can sit together and work in a group as long as the noise doesn't create a problem for anybody. As soon as that boundary has been crossed, and that's another very appropriate for me use of boundaries, is right there the noise level starts to escalate. We need immediate follow-through to withdraw the privilege until that behavior changes, which we will offer them that opportunity, say, at another time. So the dynamics are identical, whether you're working, most of my audiences are preschool through 12th grade or above. So, we're constantly adapting to, the child, the 5-year-old who needs a lot of attention versus the 15-year-old who needs a lot of attention. We still use the same dynamics. With a 5-year-old, you may give them 5 paper clips and say, okay, you can use these every time you need to see me. These need to last you until lunch. With a high school kid, you might say, this is important. I really want to hear what you have to say. Let me get these kids started on this activity, and I will be available. I've seen 4-year-olds that can wait when they know we will be available when the big hand is on the 6.
Okay. David?
Let me give you an example. I'll change the facts to protect the confidentiality of my elementary school that I represent in this particular case, but this call just came in recently. The head of school, the principal, wanted to know what to do about a young teacher, relatively new, who seemed to be was raising concerns. Other teachers were raising concerns about the way she was relating to her students. They were calling her by a familiar nickname. She was calling them by names that are usually used in friendship, such as girlfriend or stuff like that, colloquial jargon. And while there's a rule against belly shirts and things like that, and she wasn't technically, the students have the rule and the teachers have appropriate dress rule. She wasn't technically violating the rule, but she was wearing stuff so that when she, erased the blackboard, her belly button and stuff like that showed. So she wasn't technically violating any rules, but they were trying to figure out how to address it without seeming sexist or paternalistic or unreasonable. And I suggested you do it in terms of boundaries, the language, the familiarity of the language, the mixed messages of the dress. There were other behaviors, too, the way she would lie down with the students on the floor and stuff like that and play with them. While there's nothing wrong with lying down on the floor and playing with students, there were just the ways in which she was doing it raised some eyebrows. And they felt that she was behaving with the kids more as if they were friends than students. And that's a boundary issue. That's a role issue. So I suggested using the language and issues of boundaries.
Okay. Well, thanks to you both for those examples for the younger age group. I do have another email here. It is addressed to David's comment about risk factors, and this is from the White Mountain School in New Hampshire, and it says that boarding schools innately connect with three of the risk factors right off the bat. That is role confusion, power imbalance, and isolation because of the nature of those institutions. Teachers have many roles. There are many opportunities for things to happen one-on-one. They drive students in their personal vehicles. The questioner asks, what can these schools do to institutionally address these somewhat innate risk factors rather than simply trying to recognize and address the fourth one you mentioned, that is individuals who have poor boundary setting skills? You want to start with this one, David, and then Jane can jump in?
Sure. It's an astute question, and it is interesting that I did develop a lot of I started my training with institutional schools because residential schools are craving sort of protection from the risks that are just inherent in having a, you know, in living with the students. And it's obviously you can't avoid being alone with the students, and you know, in a residential school, you can't even avoid necessarily being having kids half undressed, you know, and running around. So from my point of view, having a school that has a culture of identifying and respecting boundaries and setting limits early and often is really crucial, and keeping roles straight. Giving feedback and having faculty that is not defensive and able to talk about these issues when they see questionable behaviors. One of the areas that is particularly high risk is when you get the combination of a residential school and a charismatic teacher combined. And I'm all in favor of charismatic teachers, and I love residential schools. And I don't want anyone to feel constrained by what I'm saying. But if you understand the risk factors and you address this and you talk about it at faculty meetings and you give feedback, for example, in reviews, actually put in reviews, boundary awareness. Does somebody have a good, healthy boundary awareness? Do they set limits well? Those are some of the strategies that a residential school can use.
I'm going to jump in here because we're almost out of time, and we have time for one more question. We have a caller on the line, and I'm going to ask Jane to respond to this one. It's from the Phillips Academy. Operator, would you put the question through?
Hi. It was actually basically the same question that just got answered.
Okay.
I will ask on that if David or Jane have any more specific suggestions about how to create that culture. I heard faculty meetings. I heard reviews. For example, would either of you suggest, you know, regular meetings with faculty and students to check in on this? I think most schools would do something at the beginning of the year regarding orientation, but would you advise that something more regular be done throughout the school year, and what might you suggest?
Okay, we have time for a brief response from Jane on this. Go ahead, please.
Absolutely. I like the ideas of meetings. I also want an environment where kids, where, again, using these boundaries to create the kind of environment where kids can feel safe to say, you know, I'm not comfortable with this. We typically don't encourage kids to do that, and we typically don't create an environment where it's safe for them. I've worked with staffs of residential schools, and I've worked with schools in communities where there's maybe 200 kids in the entire district. So these are kids who they see the teachers and the administrators at ball games and in the grocery stores. So I think, you know, we can give them a little bit of credit for being able to say that this person is not in that teaching role right now, and that when I'm mowing this guy's grass, he's not my teacher, he's my neighbor who's paying me so many dollars an hour for this. The reason that that works is because of the kind of boundaries that we use and set in the school. And that is, you know, obviously it's a full-day training or more for both David and myself. Kind of hard to answer that in a 30-second soundbite here, but it comes back down to that environment and the kind of trust and respect that we show students, and we encourage them to show us.
Okay.
A practical strategy is train and get feedback from student leaders on a regular basis.
Okay. Absolutely.
Thanks to you both. We are now out of time. Many thanks to all of you today who joined us for this roundtable, and a very special thanks to our speakers. We hope that you found this roundtable to be useful and informative, and we value your feedback. So please don't forget to fill out the evaluation form and either fax or email it back to us at risk@ue.org. This concludes today's program, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may all disconnect and have a wonderful day.